Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. Also, do you guys know about a field guide to the Bible? If you're a listener to this podcast and 40 Minutes, or if you're not listening to 40 Minutes, which of course you should be, Eric and I and Chad Bird have released the Old Testament portion of a new podcast called A Field Guide to the Bible. It's 16 episodes going through the entire narrative of the Old Testament, the narrative of redemption, using certain characters and events to highlight what God is doing. We are going to be dropping a New Testament portion to that this fall. So just, you know, getting your, wherever you listen to podcasts, just search A Field Guide to the Bible and subscribe to that and give it a listen. I think that you'll enjoy it. It's great for people that aren't that familiar with the scriptures or people that are familiar with the scriptures, but just want a kind of refresher on the grand narrative of the scriptures. Great for churches, for new members classes, youth groups, Bible studies, all that stuff. That's what we made it for. So check it
confirmation.
Out. Confirmation, all of that. It's 16 episodes. You get the whole Old Testament story. So check it out. A field guide.
And it's free.
Free. Field guide to the Bible. Check it out. Also, make sure you register for that Las Vegas event. Yeah, that's right. We're doing a regional event in Las Vegas. 2-day event, October 15th and 16th. We want to have you come hang out with us for sure. I'll be there. Eric will be there. Chad Bird, Scott Keith, Gretchen Ronovic, Michael Berg, Flame. It's going to be a good time. You want to come hang out with us. And it's only $65, which includes your lunch on Saturday. Come hang out with us. You can get all the information over at the events page at 1517. Register and come and hear the gospel in Sin City with a whole bunch of 1517 folks. It's going to be a good time. All right. This is episode number 2 in the old Gospel of Mark, which we have we started
the old
last
Gospel
week.
Of Mark. Yes.
Yeah. So we didn't get quite through the first chapter, but Mark is moving quick. Jesus has been baptized. Jesus has been tempted, and Jesus got to get himself some disciples, and that's where we're at now.
Yeah, that's. I mean, basically, we pointed out last time in our introductory episode that Mark is a writer in a hurry, and we certainly are going to see that as we move through the narrative again today. We pick it up at verse 16. It says, passing alongside the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew, the brother of Simon, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. Now, of course, Simon here is Peter, is who will become Peter, the man who the church fathers almost, you know, unanimously said was behind the writing of Mark's gospel. And so this is a sort of direct eyewitness report from Peter himself. And Jesus said to them, verse 17, follow me and I will make you become fishers of men.
You know what kind of a bizarre statement that is? I mean, I know that's a statement that we've heard a lot as Christians. I mean, if you've been in the church, you know about this, like fishers of men and that kind of stuff. But if you were a fisherman and you're, you know, throwing some nets out there and some guy walks by and be like, follow me, I'm going to make you fishers of men. That's not something you hear every day.
Well, it's not something you hear every day, but it's also, again, evidence that Mark often doesn't give all the details of an event that the other gospel writers do. So if you go to Luke's rendition of what takes place here, there is some context as to why Jesus can call out to them, follow me and I'll make you fishers of men. And they actually will do it, as we'll see in just a bit. And of course, that context is in Luke's gospel. Jesus tells Simon and Andrew to let out their nets on the other side of their boat, something that would have seemed completely strange to them because all the best fishing was done at night. But they do it anyway to sort of pacify him. And what do they get? This miraculous huge haul of fish. And it's based on that that they recognize that Jesus is something special. And therefore, when he says, follow me, it makes a lot of sense that they would.
Well, and also, I mean, I don't think they probably understand this fishers of men statement, but this sort of miraculous catch is enough to say, or is enough for them to say, I'm not exactly sure what you mean by fishers of men, but I'm interested in what you might mean by fishers of men, or I'm interested in finding out what exactly it is that you're about and what you're speaking of here. And so, you know, but Mark, in his typical way, just says immediately they let their nets and followed him.
That's right. Immediately.
And also, well, there's also this.
Always in Mark.
You get this like monergistic nature of Mark's gospel too, right? Like, okay, listen. Like, so a huge haul of fish is, it's a miraculous catch, but it's not like so miraculous that you could be like, well, this guy has to be God. Like, you could be like, well, that's crazy that you knew if I threw my net on that side, that would get it. Like, that's weird. I don't know if that in and of itself is enough for you to be like, you know what? Forget being a fisherman. Forget this livelihood. I'm just going to follow this guy that I just met. That's weird. But there's something weird that happens with Jesus, because when Jesus says things, things just happen. And so if Jesus says, follow me, people follow him, because there's something different about it when Jesus says it. Because when Jesus says, follow me, like, those words hit the ear and work their way down into the heart of the hearer. And, you know, you don't know that faith is created right here, but like something, like the word is alive. The word is active in this moment. And these guys follow.
Yeah. And in Luke's gospel too, you remember Peter, upon the miraculous catch of fish, does not say hooray, but in fact pleads with Jesus to depart from him because he's a sinful man. So something about this power that he's being exposed to causes him to recognize his shortcomings, and therefore, and then Jesus gives what in effect is an absolution to Peter, saying, fear not. And so there is this sense in which the absolution or the forgiveness of sins is proclaimed, and then the sinner follows Christ. And so there is, this is sort of a little picture of a conversion, so to speak. And so going on a little farther, verse 19, he saw James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, otherwise known as the sons of thunder, who were in their boat mending the nets. And immediately he called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired servants and followed him. And so there you go again, Dan. There's that, hey, you're done doing that, come follow me, and boom, monergism at its finest. They're off.
Yeah, this also shows you that these guys are probably younger than most of the depictions. I know we brought this up in previous Gospels, but in case you hadn't listened to those, I would contend that the disciples are younger than Jesus. This makes sense for how long they lived and when they wrote things, and also the way that Jesus refers to them, that Jesus is their rabbi. It's likely that Peter is the oldest of the disciples, probably the only one who's married. So, you know, Peter might be of similar age. Don't know for sure. But in this instance, you have two brothers in a boat with their father. Mm-hmm. So you think that they're basically working for their dad at this point. These are not guys in their 40s or 50s or something like that. Like, you know, you see, like, you know, portraits of the Last Supper, and like they're all gray hair, and Jesus is the young guy. This is not how this was. I guarantee you that's not how this was. I'm guessing that these were younger men, like somewhere between the ages of 17 and early 20s.
Well, and we do know, too, that at that time, if a rabbi chose you to be his disciple, it was sort of expected that, like, you went. You kind of dropped what you were doing, what you thought you were going to do for a living, and you're going to be trained by him. And so it's not totally out of the blue that an event like this would happen. Like, they had seen things like this happen before, no doubt, with other rabbis. Nevertheless, they're quite aware there's something distinct about them. There's something different, as the narrative will continue to show as we unfold it in verse 21. And they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and was teaching. And they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one who had authority and not as the scribes. Now, what does that mean? I mean, well, we know a little bit. And basically what the scribes did is they would read what the approved rabbis said a passage of scripture was all about. And so when we're contrasting, like, sort of the authority of Jesus and the scribes, Jesus is preaching and expounding the word in such a way that they can tell there's something different about the way he teaches. He's not just reading what others have written. As a matter of fact, as we move on in the narrative, you're going to see him sort of explain the scriptures in a way that many had just not even considered before.
Yeah,
you see that especially with things like the Sermon on the Mount, where he just completely takes apart, deconstructs their whole way of seeing the law of God.
Yeah, I mean, there's a difference between sort of talking about what has been written. The scribes might, you know, give you a history lesson, or they might say, and this is what this means. But if you've ever heard someone Have you ever heard the difference between someone teaching you something and somebody who proclaims something to you? These are different. And so Jesus' teaching is a proclamation. And so the authority comes in, not just him explaining what something is or what something means, but proclaiming it as true, right? Yes. And so so you might have someone teaching you saying, well, you know, and when we hear this, you might think this, or it could mean that, this other thing, or whatever. Or some say that this means this. Jesus comes in there and says, this is what this is. And like proclaims it to you, right? And so this is that is that authority that you have. And of course, he has that authority because he is proclaiming his own words.
That's right. That's right. And they sense this. I mean, the crowd senses this. There's something different about it. But in case there was any confusion about his authority, well, what happens next clears that up right away. Verse 23, and immediately there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, what have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God. So the demons are making a statement of faith that actually happens to be true. He is the Holy One of God. But Jesus rebuked him, saying, be silent and come out of him. And the unclean spirit, convulsing him and crying out with a loud voice, came out of him. And they were all amazed, so that they questioned among themselves, saying, what is this? A new teaching with authority. He commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him. And at once his fame spread everywhere throughout all the surrounding region of Galilee. Now, so you do have what you typically see throughout the narrative of the Gospels, is you have both word and sign to authenticate that word. You see this in the book of Acts. When the church goes out, they are given power to do signs. Why? So that the word they proclaim is authenticated. It's validated in people's minds. And we know that in Jewish life, both things were expected for anybody that would have the audacity to claim to be the Holy One of God. Now, it is important here that Jesus has not proclaimed that necessarily in this context, in this place, about himself yet. He does earlier in the gospel already, as he says, the kingdom of God is here, and repent. But in this place, he's actually kind of silencing this demonic set of persons, it appears like. Or it appears to be a multiple demons because they talk in the plural, but he silences them. Nevertheless, he does the sign to get rid of the demons so that indeed his word will be trusted.
Yeah. And it seems that, you know, this demon or demons, what's going on here is they're trying to out who he is before it is time for him to out who he is. So they're trying to publicly declare that this person is God, and they do that. They are doing this as a one out of fear that God has now entered the world, right? And and they are wondering, are you here to destroy us? Which is the answer is yes,
mm-hmm. Yes.
So they know this, and then two, then trying to make it known that that's who he is to the religious leaders, because as we'll see, it's going to be the claim of being God that's going to end up really pitting the religious leaders against Jesus.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the Talmud, which is a collection of rabbinical writings that go back some time, actually do talk about Jesus. And when they do, they say the reason that he was crucified, the reason that he was executed is because of blasphemy. In other words, because he was, yes, indeed, claiming to be God. And so that is something that's even authenticated in something that is not a particularly friendly writing to Jesus and the Christian church at the time it was written. But there's also the reality what they're trying to do is hinted at here at verse 28, where it says, at once his fame spread everywhere. Well, what does this do for his ministry also? It makes it very hard for him to get around because everybody hears he can do these things. And so he's surrounded by people everywhere he goes. And that is part of what's going on here. And so we pick it up at verse 29, and immediately he left the synagogue. There's that word immediately again. Mark wants you to know everything's happening fast. Immediately he left the synagogue and entered the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. Now, Simon's mother-in-law lay ill with a fever, And immediately they told him about her. And he came and took her by the hand and lifted her up. And the fever left her, and she began to serve them. Now, Dan, I've always loved that picture because, again, it's sort of a brief picture of what God does to sinners. He touches them. He lifts them up. And then they, in turn, as a worshipful response, begin to serve. It's just a nice little vignette.
Yeah,
how this whole thing works.
Yeah, you're going to see this a lot. You're going to see that Jesus touching somebody when he heals them. Now, there'll be times where he can just speak it if it's someone that's a great distance from him or something like this. But when he has the opportunity, Jesus lays his hands upon the sick. What this has to do with is you'll see him speak to demons and remove them. The word will do this. But when it comes to sickness and illness, he will lay his hands on people more often than not. Mm-hmm. And what this is about is it's about Jesus taking on the sins of the world. Now, it's not a sin.
Absorbing them.
Yeah, it's not a sin to be sick. But sickness is a ramification of sin, not necessarily your particular sin. Sin, big sin, all engulfing mm-hmm. sin, the fall. This woman is Peter's. You might look at this. Peter's mother-in-law is not sick because she committed any specific sin. She is sick because of your sin, my sin, the world's sin. She's sick because of sin, because it's without sin, there is no sickness. Jesus is coming and taking that from her.
Yes. Christ comes to take sin and all that is connected to or a result of sin in our world.
Yeah. So he will speak and cast out a demon, but for the sick, he will come and take that upon himself.
Mm-hmm. So verse 32, that evening at sundown, they brought to him all who were sick or oppressed by demons, and the whole city was gathered together at the door. And he healed many who were sick with various diseases and cast out many demons. And he would not permit the demons to speak because they knew him.
Yeah, so this is him still not quite ready to say, by the way, I'm God.
Yes. No, and you're going to see this. This is what some scholars refer to as sort of the messianic secret, that there is a time frame at which Jesus wants to declare to the world who he is and when he's going to do it. And he doesn't want them to speak about him. He doesn't want the demons proclaiming anything about him. As a matter of fact, as we'll go on to see, I think before the end of today's podcast, is he doesn't even want other people to be talking about him necessarily yet, but that doesn't always work out very well.
Yeah.
So verse 35, and rising very early in the morning while it was still dark, he departed and went out to a desolate place, and there he prayed. And Simon and those who were with him searched for him, and they found him and said to him, "Everyone is looking for you." And he said to them, "Let us go on to the next towns that I may preach there also, for that is why I came out." And he went throughout all Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and casting out demons. Now, Dan, I do love this example given to us by our Lord, because in the midst of surely knowing that everyone is looking for him and they all have demands of him, they all want him to, of course, fix their issues, fix their problems, because he can. Nevertheless, he still takes time to get out of there and pray.
Yeah, I mean, you see Jesus do this quite a bit, where his humanity is on display as he actually finds all of this exhausting, that he's someone who gets tired. He's someone who desires communion with the Father. All of these things are true about him. And so you'll see him withdraw many times in his ministry.
And there's, of course, a good lesson of application here for anybody who might be in pastoral ministry. There can often be this feeling that, you know, there's 100 things that you have to do on any given day, and there's all sorts of demands that, yes, I mean, things need to be done, but it's important to get away. It's important to spend some time in prayer. It's important for us. If Jesus needed to do that, how much more do we need to do that? It's a no-brainer. We can't be there for every need all the time. And I do love the fact that, I mean, there's this sense of mission, very clear mission in the mind of Jesus as he's, yes, everyone's looking for me. Let's go on to the next towns. We've got a job to do. We got to preach the gospel to as many people as we possibly can. So we're moving on.
Yeah. It seems like if somebody, you know, if you're a preacher and they're like, hey man, there's a ton of people down here ready for you to come down here. Most people's response is like, that's nice. Let's go to the next town. Cause I think I'm going to go preach over there. So this is Jesus. Like, he's not really interested in like setting up a church somewhere. He's a traveling evangelist. And he's just going to hit all of these towns. This is why I came out. I came out to just travel around, and you'll see that those crowds will grow. People will follow him from town to town, all of this kind of stuff. But Jesus never camps out in one space, you know, one spot, and like builds himself a church.
Yeah. Yeah. He's constantly on the move. And Mark emphasizes that maybe more than anyone else in the Gospels. Always, always, always moving immediately. And so we pick it up at verse 40, and a leper came to him, imploring him, and kneeling said to him, if you will, you can make me clean. That's a wonderful prayer, by the way.
What you have here is this prayer is not that if you will, that not like if you, not if you'll do it, but if it is your will, if you desire, you can make me clean. If this is something that you desire to do.
Yeah.
And so this is a great prayer that he prays. That's quite the prayer of faith, but also not a presumptuous prayer. It's just a prayer of faith that says, if it is in your heart to make me clean, you can.
Yeah. And it's a statement of faith.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you have this wonderful sentence, moved with pity. You ever think about what it means to have a God who is moved with pity, a God who is even able to be moved with pity? So Jesus is moved with pity, and what we see again, he stretched out his hand and touched him and said, I will, or I do desire to do this, be clean. So you have, again, that touch, that Jesus touches this man. And, you know, for a leper...
That didn't happen ever.
No one touched a leper. I mean, this is a crazy thing that happens. And Jesus puts his hand on him. As we stated, this is common with miracles involving disease and sickness.
Just to be clear, it could have been years since another human being had touched this man.
Yeah.
That would not have been uncommon. Like, you couldn't, I mean, leprosy was gotten, it was, you know, you got it through touch. So no one touched a leper. And so for Jesus being moved with pity, divine compassion, which, by the way, such a contrast from, you know, sort of man-made gods, you know, man-made gods, whether it be in the Greek pantheon or whatever the case may be, are always seen as sort of above it all and too powerful to care about our little needs and our problems here. You know, they can't be bothered with such things. Jesus in the flesh, God in the flesh comes and he is moved. And this is far from the only time that we see this emotion displayed on behalf of people that have been plagued by the results of sin in our world. And so moved with pity, touches him and indeed cleans him up. And immediately the leprosy left him and he was made clean. And Jesus sternly charged him and sent him away at once and said to him. So, I mean, this is, you know, it's very clear, like, hey, you need to listen to me. Sternly charged him, see that you say nothing to anyone. Don't say a word about what's happened, but go show yourself to the priest and offer for your cleansing what Moses commanded for a proof to them. This was standard fare. This is what the law instructed you, that if you were clean, that you were supposed to go to the temple or to the synagogue and show that you indeed were now clean so that you could re-enter the fellowship of God's people. That was because you couldn't go to worship. You could not go to the synagogue or to the temple if you had leprosy. So this was Jesus saying, go and show them so that you can be reoriented back into the fellowship of God's people. Don't tell them who did it for you. Don't tell them about me.
And that's exactly what this guy went and did. He went and followed these instructions. Because what you know is that people who if Jesus has done something amazing for someone, you know, I don't know, like die for them and forgive them all their sins, what they obviously do after that is do exactly what he tells them to do immediately following that. And for the rest of their life, that's what they do, which is exactly what this guy does. After receiving this wonderful gift from the hand of Jesus, he goes and listens to Jesus' words exactly not at all. And immediately he goes out and began to talk freely about it.
Yeah, they're just, you got to wonder at what point he was just like, you know, it says he went out and began to talk freely about it. It's almost as if instantly he was like, yeah, whatever. Sorry, I'm going to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Mark doesn't do a lot of, he's so fast moving stuff through things. He doesn't double down on a lot of things. But in this instance, he says he began to talk freely about it and to spread the news that so that Jesus could no longer openly enter a town. I mean, so this guy, this leper, has now sabotaged Jesus' ability to just freely move around. So this guy isn't just like freely talking about it. He's spreading it like far and wide. This is exactly the opposite of what Jesus told him to do. He's doing it, of course, out of joy. And I mean, and all this thing. But it does tell you that even a guy who's healed cannot follow the simple instructions of...
And he's not the only one. You've got the demoniacs, you know, in the Gerasenes that immediately go and tell, even though they're instructed not to. The woman at the well goes and tells. This seems to be a common thread that when people come across Jesus and they experience his healing, they experience his cleansing and his forgiveness, they can't help it. They just can't help it. They end up going out and blabbing their mouth.
Yeah. I mean, and what the result of this is that Jesus could no longer enter a town. So he's out in desolate places now, it says. Like, so he's trying to escape the crowds, and people were coming to him from every quarter, it says. So Jesus is trying to sort of escape the mobs and the crowds, and he's going out into the middle of nowhere, and people are just flocking in.
Well, one of the great things about this particular story in verses 40 to 45 is you even here see the kind of great exchange that takes place. Because as Jesus restores this leper's ability to fellowship, where does Jesus end up as a result? In the place exactly where a leper would have had to be, a desolate place. So even here, you're seeing a sort of hint of the great exchange that will take place that is talked about in places like 2 Corinthians 5, where we're told that he who knew no sin became sin for us so that we might become the righteousness of God. Jesus is executed outside of the city so that we might gain entrance into the great city of God. You see this all over the place in scriptures, and indeed you see it here as the leper is restored to fellowship, but Jesus is forced out.
Yeah, that's a big key. Yeah, the leper gets to re-enter society, while Jesus has to depart from society. This is not the last time this sort of thing will happen. Jesus doesn't care about the size of crowds. Jesus is not interested in amassing a huge following or anything like that. He is about the work that he is there to do. Now the crowds will come and they will follow, but Jesus
cares about the individuals.
Yes.
I mean, he takes time to care about individual persons, whether it be the woman with an issue of blood, whether it be the woman at the well, the adulterous woman. There's these individuals that he takes the time to care for. And he clearly would seem not to have the time. And indeed, if I was in that situation, I could see myself being like, I'm sorry, you see the crowds around me. I've got a lot more to deal with. I can't just spend time dealing with you. Not so with Jesus. Jesus cares about the individual and goes to the greatest lengths to show them.
Yeah, I mean, you know for sure if, you know, when a Gentile woman is trying to approach Jesus and the disciples are shooing her away, and if children are trying to get to Jesus and the disciples are shooing them away, you know for sure when a leper rolled up that the disciples were like, okay, don't get too close. I mean, this had to have been a pretty crazy scene.
You're not going to be able to continue your mission if you get leprosy.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they were all backed up and covering their faces and everything like that. This must have just been a shocking scene for them to see Jesus as opposed to recoil, like what like all of them no doubt were doing, to see him approach him and lay his hand on him. This would have been a crazy scene.
Yeah.
And next week, we will get into, I mean, I know we say this kind of stuff a lot, but like next week we are going to get into, I don't know how this isn't my favorite Bible, gospel story, period. I just don't know how it isn't. I mean, you want to talk about a passage of scripture that I love, it is in Mark chapter 2.
For multiple reasons, too.
Yeah.
There's multiple things that we get to pull out next week.
Yeah, so. It's going to be great. So join us there. Hey, make sure you check out A Field Guide to the Bible. Search that wherever you listen to podcasts. And make sure you subscribe to that and sign up for the conference in October. Eric, I'll see you next week.
Sounds good.